Space Case 037, John Cage, Part 1. John Cage. He was a composer and music theorist. He was one of those very special people that looked around early in life and saw things that weren't happening right, and he broke from the pack. And when I say things weren't happening right, I mean that he was seeing that everyone was doing the same thing the same way. Steve Jobs, I mean, that was the Apple guy, right? He was one of those that broke away from the pack and said, hey, well, you can do it like this. Miles Davis, yet another one. Coltrane. But John Cage, who studied with Arnold Schoenberg, he was way out. We're still trying to figure out what Cage was doing. He was into playing those prepared piano compositions. This is when you put objects like rocks and pencils on the strings of the piano to alter the sound. And he was into chance music, too. Look him up, though, if you want the whole bio. But his magnum opus, the one piece that if you've heard of Cage or people that talk about John Cage to some degree, that piece is entitled 4 Minutes 33 Seconds, 4:33. This is a piece of music, if you can call it that, in which the pianist takes the stage and sits at the piano for 4 minutes and 33 seconds without playing. And the performance is in the silence and extraneous sounds that the audience hears in that four and a half minutes. It's still controversial, but it challenges ideas about what we as musicians and audiences think about music performance. You know, is it really just music performance, is it really just the music coming out? I mean, is there something more to it? I've thought about it a lot during the years since music school, in which we talked about it very little. You know, it was always mentioned in some history book, or I'd catch something about it, even caught a couple of performances of somebody coming out on stage and sitting quietly at the piano. And then I started looking, said, you're supposed to, and there is a lot of sounds. It made me think about what's happening during a performance. You know, it challenged my ideas, you know, about how every performance is different. You know, even in the same venue with the same players playing the same music. And it gave me, and it still does, that environment plays a role in performance. You know, room temperatures, acoustics, lights, placement of the audiences, placement of the musicians, numbers of the audience's mood and temperament, all these things affect performances. They're deep and profound ideas, but they're well worth thinking about, and they're out there too. I mean, seriously, I played sets in the same venue for two or more nights in a row, and every night felt different. You know, and I'm talking about playing with the same group, playing the same set at the same time Friday night, and then doing the same thing Saturday night, and it felt different both nights. You know, and you want to be sensitive enough to realize these things, and I hope that you are, but I'm somewhat digressing. Several years ago, a colleague of mine came by, and he dropped something on my desk, and it was 10 Rules for Students and Teachers by John Cage. And it was a copy, and it was obviously taken probably from the original. And it looked like it had been typewritten. It's online. It's easy to find. But there was some really good advice from this person that had thought about music and composed a lot of music. It's sort of more of my practicing without your instrument, but in a different way. You know, not thinking about lines, but thinking about what we do as musicians and how we can get better with the right approaches, you know, and sometimes those approaches are mental approaches. And also finding new approaches of doing this, playing music. I'm going to go out of order, and I'm not going to be able to do all 10 during this podcast, but I'm going to go with my favorite. And my favorite on his list of 10 is Nothing is a Mistake. He writes, nothing is a mistake. There is no win or no fail. There is only make. I mean, think about that. How many people struggle to start something? you know, or to finish something. You know, a friend of mine calls it perfection paralysis. They get caught in that. You know, it's not good enough, so they can't even start it. They can't even put the first note down. They can't even attempt to play the first note or write the first note. And you have to start. You know, in past episodes from last summer, I talked about Stephen Nachmanovich's free play, and he says the same thing. You know, you've got to feel comfortable enough to start, and you've got to keep moving on it. You know, we're not going to start perfectly. You're going to have to find your way sometimes in there. A friend of mine sent a guitar track to me, and he says, hey, would you come up with a bass line for this? And I listened to it for a while, and I was really stuck on what to do outside of playing roots or, you know, figuring out what he had there. And I had to keep dropping things in on it, and I started finding my way in there. But initially, no, there was nothing happening. You know, it was just, but I had to start making something. You know, John Cage's rule, there's only one rule, make. You know, we have to start. We have to start learning a line. We have to start writing a line. We have to start writing a composition and just start, not think about, is this good enough? Writers, you know, authors, people write monographs, articles. They say 10 pages of bad writing is better than no pages of no writing, because you can always fix what you wrote. You can make something out of it. Because what are you doing? You're doing what John Cage said, to start making. You can always go back and repair, and at least you got something done. You've made. I like the way Miles Davis said it. You see the quote all the time, nothing is a mistake. Just start. Start playing bass. Start playing that line. Start up. Stop worrying about it being wrong or not good enough. You can fix it or make it better later. I see my players do that, especially some of my new ones. You know, learning to play double bass with the bow, especially with the players, the young players that come in, and they come from electric bass and they sound good on electric bass. They start playing with the bow, and it doesn't sound the way that they want to sound, you know, i.e. it doesn't sound very good. Their tone's not there. They haven't done it enough. They've never done it, you know, and I have to say, you got to keep moving. You know, you've got to keep working this out. I remember that. You know, I'm an electric bass player that moved to double bass, and now I like my tone with the bow. I can live with it. You know, I'm always trying to improve it, but I can deal with it. But I remember a time when it sounded horrible, at least to my ears. I remember one time when I was first studying Arco, and I had a teacher, and I was in the studio, and he says, hey, play C major. And he goes, with the bow. And he started laughing, and I was like, you know, this isn't really helping, right? He goes, I'm just laughing. He goes, at his expression on your face. He goes, it's like you hate what you're doing. He says, it doesn't sound that bad. And that's the reality of it, that if you're making something, it's probably not as bad as you think it is. You hear about this concept, you know, I read a lot about this stuff, especially these days, about mindfulness training, and that's a big part of it, you know, to be and do. You know, and that leads me to Cage's rule number 7. He said, the only rule is work. If you work, it will lead to something. And then in that same number 7, he says, it is the people who do all the work all the time who eventually catch on to things. You know, I eventually caught on to that tone that I wanted. You know, same for bass players, you know, catch on to the lines that I wanted to play. But you have to work to lead to something. How obvious is that? But it can be difficult to do that. You know, if you're struggling with it, you don't feel like you're getting anywhere, then you don't want to pick up the instrument. But that's the wrong thing to do, because you're getting further from it. For bass players, work on it, think about it, you know, use what you have, talk about it, you know, be it if you can. Instead of thinking and obsessing on why you can't do something, why you can't execute a line, work on it. Work on it in different ways. Slow it down. Talk about it with someone else, you know. it's always big with people saying, talk about your problems, but musicians don't typically do that, you know, a lot. You say, I'm having trouble with this line, or I don't know what to do with the bridge of rhythm changes, you know, and somebody's got some idea. Just talking about the, you know, I can't tell you how many times that I've talked about a problem that I'm having musically, and as I'm talking about it, an answer presents itself. You know, it could be just listening to it some more. You know, related to that, when I was a first-year music student, you know, and I didn't know anything, I was in an improv class. And that's where we were kind of like my combo class. You know, we were playing jazz standards and soloing. And, you know, I was walking lines and playing bossa grooves and working with the chord charts. And I couldn't figure out how my instructor knew which scale to play against which chord. He was all the time railing out, playing, play Dorian against this, or, you know, play Lydian against this. You know, it's really basic stuff to me, but at the time, not really. You know, he'd say, play Phil, play Dorian over this D minor chord. You know, he had had me learn all the modes. He'd say, walk Mixolydian, you know, dominant scale right over these five chords. But I couldn't wrap my mind around it. You know, I was like, how does he, why does this fit like this? You know, how does he do that? He's a cryptic guy, you know, great teacher, though. And I asked him after class, I said, how do you know which scale to put on which chord? And he looked at me, man, he was cryptic again. He says, think about it, sport. And he walked off. And I did think about it. And then I didn't think about it. Then I did some more. And then I was looking at a poster of the bass neck on the wall of my room, and there were arpeggios detailed on this oversized poster of the bass neck. And I wasn't really thinking about what we were doing in class. I was just looking at the arpeggios, and it hit me. I was like, the arpeggios, you know, the scale, the chords, right? I can superimpose the arpeggios against the scale, and they'll fit perfectly if I'm doing the right one. I can take the notes of C major 7, C, E, G, B, and they'll fit into a C major scale. That's it. That's the chord scale theory. He was right, right, in making me thinking about it. Think about it, right? It was a little off-putting when he first told me that, but it was really the thing to do because I became a chord scale theory guy very quickly after that. You know, thinking about what I was doing, thinking about the different scales, and okay, yeah, an alt, a D alt, right? You know, an altered dominant chord. There's a lot of scales that can fit over that, but why, you know? But thinking about it, making stuff. If you're not working on something new, begin to do so, you know, or if you're not finishing something, start getting ready to finish it, right? Challenge yourself and deal with it. I'll talk to you next time. You can email me at phil@basecase.co.